Hello, and welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program, a special program on Labor Day. In a few minutes, Dennis Mihalik will be speaking with Christy Lindenmeyer about the history of child labor in the United States. But first, let's look back at this week, September 7th through the 13th in history. On September 8th, 1935, Huey Long, senator from Louisiana, known as the Kingfish, was shot. He died 2 days later. On September 9th, 1776, the Second Continental Congress made the term United States official, replacing the phrase they had been using, United Colonies. Apropos our Labor Day show, on September 10th, 1897, 20 striking coal miners in Pennsylvania were killed when sheriff's deputies opened fire on them. The next day, September 11th, the strike in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia ended, with miners winning an 8-hour workday. On September 12, 1938, in a speech in Nuremberg, Adolf Hitler demanded self-determination for Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia. And on September 13, 1971, a 4-day inmates' rebellion at the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York ended as police and guards stormed the prison. The final assault claimed 43 lives. Turning to this week's History in the News segment, a dossier recently released by the British Public Records Office reveals that British agents plotted several ways of killing Adolf Hitler in the last months of World War II, including use of a sniper, high explosives, a trail derailment, and poison. Operation Foxley, as it has been named, was approved by British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill was informed of it, but no action was taken. And Steven Spielberg's project to film 50,000 interviews with World War II Holocaust survivors and witnesses is nearing its goal. A spokesman for Spielberg's Shoah Visual History Foundation reports that when completed, the material will be available to schools, libraries, and other users around the world. The project was spawned by Spielberg's Oscar-winning movie, Schindler's List. You're listening to Talking History.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons.
Well, this week we celebrate Labor Day, recognizing the contributions of labor and laborers of all walks of life to the nation's prosperity. Unfortunately, the history of labor in the United States is not without its sadder moments. Here to discuss one of those unfortunate subjects in our labor history, child labor, is my colleague, Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. Within the past 2 years, frequent news stories have documented the exploitation of child labor in third world countries. Actually, the United States government has only been regulating child labor for 60 years. As we celebrate Labor Day, which was made a national holiday in 1894, our guest today, Dr. Christy Lindenmeyer, will put the issues of child labor into historical perspective. Dr. Lindenmeyer is currently an associate professor of history at Tennessee Technological University, and she is the author of the book, A Right to Childhood, subtitled The U.S. Children's Bureau and Child Welfare, 1912 to 1946, published by the University of Illinois Press. Welcome, Dr. Lindenmeyer.
Well, thank you.
If we begin with the title of your book, would you explain this interesting concept of a right to childhood?
Certainly. The whole structure of childhood is really a cultural phenomenon. It's changed over time. The history of childhood is not something that's been consistent from the beginning of human existence. It's something that we've certainly developed as a society and is different in each society. In 1905, Florence Kelly published a book where she said that a right to childhood follows from the existence of the Republic and must be guarded in order to guard its life. So in other words, she was saying that childhood was a modern construction that came with representative democracy and should be respected and maintained by that government.
Okay. Now, how does that relate to children working?
Well, certainly children have always worked. There's nothing that isn't work when you are on the family farm when it comes to childhood. It just seemed that somehow in a modern society where increasing numbers of children were working in factories, working as street workers, selling things on the street like newspapers or other kinds of goods, and also working in agribusiness, that this was a new concept of children working that seemed to suggest exploitation, and that in fact modernization did mean exploitation of children. So at the end of the 19th century, some reformers began to think that childhood was a unique period of life that needed protection, that the old ways of experiencing the period between being an infant and being an adult were not applicable in a more modern society.
Okay. So if we look at children and working then, I mean, which children would work? I mean, obviously, the children of wealthy parents wouldn't hold a job outside the house, correct?
Certainly. And even today, I would argue that our definitions of childhood vary based on class. We increasingly have talked about in the last few years that troubled adolescents who are engaged in violent crime, if they are adolescents of a lower socioeconomic status, nobody seems to have any problems, or at least I won't say nobody, but few people seem to have problems with giving those adolescents adult punishment, where we seem to suggest that children of a higher class or a better socioeconomic class should be have extended adolescence that extends into graduate school like some of us have been in for a very long time. So those definitions certainly vary by class. And when it comes to working, at the turn of the century, of all children, about 20% of children between 10 and 14 years of age labored for wages. And if you divided that by class, certainly those of the poorest families had much higher rates of wage labor than those in the better-off families.
Mm-hmm. And would a person's race or immigrant ethnic background affect their rates of work?
Absolutely. Immigrant children, of course, worked at much higher rates. Interestingly enough, though, if black children generally worked in agricultural labor, even though many of them would certainly be among the poorer ranks of families in society. And white children tended to be those, particularly in the South, who worked in the textile mills. And the textile industry was infamous for its exploitation of child labor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Textiles, farm labor, what other kinds of jobs would children hold in rural America versus urban America?
Well, certainly in rural America, another common form of child labor besides working in agriculture and textile mills was working in mines. And this became one of the major things that got reformers' attention. In 1902, there was an anthracite coal strike in the fields of Pennsylvania and northern West Virginia. And it became very obvious that many of the workers in these mines were children. And the young boys who worked as slate pickers in these mines when they grew to adulthood, if they made it that far, often had all kinds of health problems, physical hindrances. They, of course, because they didn't attend school, were illiterate, and illiteracy rates among many of these mine workers were as high as 85%. Often the boys also, because of the physical difficulty of the job that they did, not only carried lung problems with them, but new workers on the conveyor belts where they picked out the slate would be called red tips by the other boys because the slate was so sharp that it would cut their fingers and they would bleed, and until they could develop calluses on the end of their fingers, which sometimes would be encouraged by pouring urine on the boys' fingers to toughen them up, those red tips were literally blood red tips from working at this very difficult job.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that these kinds of jobs are being done by boys. Mm-hmm. Would young girls also hold employment?
Girls often worked in textile mills. They also worked in food production factories, shelling oysters, picking shells off shrimp. Those kinds of jobs were also available to girls. But it certainly was higher or more likely for boys to be employed in wage labor positions than girls, because often what happened with girls was that it wasn't that they didn't work, but they were used as what turn-of-the-century language would have been little mothers. They did the babysitting for families where both parents had to work, particularly among sharecroppers and tenant farmers. We talk today a lot about daycare. It's not that working parents at the turn of the century didn't need daycare. It's just that they used children to babysit for other children.
Okay. Now, obviously, you talked about illiteracy as being one of the negative effects of this working. Generally speaking, who was for regulating child labor and why?
The group that historians and themselves identified as progressive reformers were most interested in child labor regulations at the turn of the century. These were the same people that advocated reform in health departments, also labor unions, many kinds of regulations that we generally accept today as just part of a standard modern society. These folks were also interested in the conservation movement, the environmental conservation movement, and they many times used the same language to try to encourage conservation of what they saw as human beings that needed to be conserved for the future, as they used to describe conservation of resources, environmental resources. And those kinds of folks who were interested in government regulation in many aspects of people's lives were the ones most advocating for child labor reform.
Mm-hmm. Now, who was against it and why?
Well, interestingly enough, there's an odd mix of folks who were strange bedfellows, I guess we could say, on the issue of opposing child labor regulation. It might be certainly obvious that some of the industries that exploited these children were interested in prohibiting child labor or trying to stop any kind of child labor regulation. The southern textile mills were probably the most obvious at that. Also, the American Manufacturers Association. Interestingly enough, newspaper editors were also very much against any kind of child labor regulation because they used newsies or young boys and girls on the streets to sell newspapers, and they felt that this was an unfair regulation of their businesses and would prohibit these children from becoming quote-unquote entrepreneurs. Another group that was against child labor regulation was the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church, in a time of very strong anti-Catholic sentiment, was afraid of any sort of regulation for children that might step on parental rights and might prohibit parents from sending their kids to private Catholic schools, or might suggest birth control and birth control regulation. So anything that seemed to be into the area of parental rights was something the Catholic Church certainly didn't like. Conservative politicians were another group who often talked about child regulation as an invasion of parental rights. And interestingly enough, working class parents who needed the income of their children to supplement their meager incomes for a family to survive. So it's a very interesting mix of folks who were opposed to this.
Yes, it was. Now, the reformers want to regulate child labor. I mean, how did they go about regulating it? I found it very interesting, for example, that you talk about the introduction of birth certificates.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the first efforts to regulate child labor were as early as 1842. I believe it was Massachusetts and Connecticut who passed the first child labor regulations. And those regulated the labor of children, paid labor of children between the ages of 10 and 14 to only 10 hours a day. Those were early onset. Various states then passed some form of child labor regulation throughout the 19th century until we get to about 1906 when the federal government made its first attempt. There was a failed attempt, but its first attempt. The way that they wanted to enforce child labor laws as these laws became available state by state was through age requirements, and you couldn't have age requirements without birth certificates. So in 1915, the U.S. Children's Bureau called for national application of birth certificates within the states. I mean, it would be easy to lie about a child's age if there was no official record of when the child was actually born.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in our own era of conservatism and getting the federal government off your back, why would these reformers want a federal law?
They needed a federal law because even though several states had passed child labor regulation by the establishment of the Children's Bureau in 1912, there were other regions, there were parts of the country where there were no child labor regulations. For example, in the southern states, no southern state had passed any such laws. And that, of course, was where most of the employed children worked. So they felt that they needed a federal law because there was no uniform application of such ideas, and a federal law would have been the only way to make sure that it happened in every state.
Okay. When were these federal statutes passed then?
Well, as I said, the first attempt was in 1906, but that one did fail. Then there was another attempt in 1916 called the Keating-Owen Act. It actually did pass Congress, was designed to be implemented in 1918. But before it was actually implemented, the Supreme Court declared the law unconstitutional. The court decision involved a father named Reuben Dagenhart and his sons. And his sons worked in a cotton mill, a textile mill in North Carolina. He argued that it was a violation of his son's constitutional rights to earn a living, to earn income, if they were prohibited from working in the mill. He won that case. The Supreme Court wasn't sympathetic to child labor regulation, but they felt that the way the Keating-Owen Act was worded, that it actually was came in through the back door by prohibiting interstate commerce of goods that were produced by child labor, that that was an unconstitutional application, and therefore a federal law using that argument could not hold up. There was another attempt then after that, which was also declared unconstitutional in Drexel versus Bailey Furniture Company. And so it became clear to the reformers that if they were going to have federal regulation, at least in the culture of this Supreme Court, they would have to have a constitutional amendment. And that constitutional amendment was passed by Congress in 1922-23, but not ratified by the necessary number of states. So we've never had a constitutional amendment that regulates child labor. However, the Supreme Court atmosphere changed in the 1930s with the onset of the Depression and Roosevelt's New Deal. And in 1938, a new law that regulating labor on many levels throughout the United States included a prohibition and several other very distinct kinds of prohibitions against child labor. And that's what we work with today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, that's all the time that we have. We have been talking with Dr. Christy Lindenmeyer, Associate Professor of History at Tennessee Technological University, about the history of child labor in the United States.
Turning to this week's radio op-ed piece, also on labor, I'm pleased to introduce David Larson, a professor of labor and employment law at Creighton University. In his comments, Professor Larson answers the question, what should we be celebrating on Labor Day?
Well, it's Labor Day. We get to enjoy a long weekend, and of course, it's the unofficial end of the summer. Does Labor Day mean anything else? Today, only one out of every 10 American workers belongs to a labor union. That's the ratio in the private sector, where most of us work. But not that long ago, in the 1950s, the ratio was 1 out of every 3 American workers. Of course, 40, 50, 60 years ago, it seems that workers really needed labor unions. I remember my grandfather, an immigrant who settled in Chicago. He had 5 daughters and worked as a streetcar conductor. He was the guy who stood on the platform at the back of the car by the rear entrance, taking money from the customers. He stood outside in Chicago in the winter in the 1930s and 40s. My mother used to tell me how he'd stuff his shoes and pants with newspapers in an effort to stay warm. The hours were long and hard. The wages were low. It certainly seems my grandfather needed a labor union. But today, in 1998, do we still need labor unions? We've got minimum wages, guaranteed overtime pay, health insurance, retirement plans, all kinds of benefits that did not exist earlier this century. How do we get these protections? Primarily because of labor unions. Okay, labor unions get most of the credit for securing these benefits. But now we already have these workplace protections. Do we still need labor unions? The danger is that none of this is etched in stone. Employer-provided health insurance, retirement plans, these benefits are not required by law. Employers do not have to offer these plans. Guaranteed overtime pay, this is required by law, but a serious effort is going on right now in Congress to remove that guarantee and to substitute time off for overtime pay, which, although attractive to some, would be disastrous for workers who make the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour, or less than $11,000 per year. Although it's supposed to be the worker's choice, many will be afraid to demand overtime pay. There is a real danger that if labor unions disappear, so will some of the workplace protections we now take for granted. But if unions are so great, why do only 10% of American workers in the private sector join labor unions? Union leaders have to take a lot of the responsibility. There's been too much chest thumping, not enough educating. They haven't explained, for instance, that a union can give workers at least some control at the workplace, that a union, in effect, democratizes the workplace. The U.S. is a country based on democratic principles. We really shouldn't be afraid of a little democracy at work. We should embrace it. In fact, a properly run union is a great place to learn and practice democracy. And if the United States is going to continue to thrive, we need citizens who understand and participate in our democracy. If labor unions are going to survive, they probably are going to have to be less confrontational, less adversarial. We may need new labor legislation, and union leaders must become more trustworthy, more accessible, more familiar. Is there a reason to celebrate Labor Day? Make no mistake about it. Most of the benefits we enjoy as workers were secured by labor unions. If labor unions disappear, those benefits and protections may also disappear, or at least shrink dramatically. So we should celebrate Labor Day. We should celebrate working conditions that are unimaginable to millions, if not billions, of less fortunate workers around the world. But we should ask ourselves if our jobs and working conditions are truly as secure as we think they are, and we should acknowledge that if you want to improve your workplace in 1998, this Congress isn't going to help you. It's going to require the help of a labor union.
You've been listening to David Larson, Professor of Labor and Employment Law at Creighton University. Continuing on our theme this week of celebrating labor history, we have chosen for our site of the week the town of Pullman, Illinois. Here to describe Pullman is Talking History's producer, Cindy Workman. Cindy?
Thanks, Brian. In 1880, George Pullman, the founder of Pullman Place Car Company, created the town of Pullman, Illinois, on 4,000 acres just west of Lake Calumet, which is now part of Chicago. The town's residents, Pullman workers and their families, enjoyed housing with all the modern conveniences, including indoor plumbing. There were parks, office buildings, a bank, a theater, a church, a post office, and recreational facilities as well. Pullman was presented an award for the world's most perfect town, but during the Depression of 1893 and 94, trouble came to Pullman Town. In order to keep his business open, Pullman reduced wages and hours, which resulted in the famous Pullman strike of 1894, and the town never recovered. Pullman died in 1897. While much of Pullman Town is gone or privately owned, there is still plenty to see. Many of the homes in the original factory buildings were preserved, and some Pullman cars are there as well. Pullman Town became a National Landmark District in 1971.
And finally, we have our segment on coming attractions, upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that may be of interest to our listeners. A new exhibit at the American Textile History Museum in Lowell, Massachusetts, Textiles in America, recently opened. The exhibit provides visitors with examples of textile machinery in all shapes and sizes from the pre-industrial period to the 1950s. Visitors can see framed daguerreotypes of proud factory workers and examples of advertising from the past two centuries. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Join us next week for our discussion of the place of history in the American Film Institute's recently voted 100 best movies of all time. But in the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.